Section 4, Transitions in the Countryside. As you read, look for problems faced by the state's farmers, the expansion of sharecropping, organizations founded to help the state's farmers, and the following terms: furnishing merchant, farmers alliance, farmer cooperative store, money supply, collateral, and populist party. While North Carolina's urban population grew after Reconstruction, the vast majority of the state's residents continued to live in the country. In fact, the farming communities were growing as fast as the towns. This created a crisis. By 1890, there were so many farm families that there was not enough good land that was fertile enough to raise good crops. As a result, many farm families lost money for years. Some farmers actually lost control of their finances and even their land and homes. More farms, same amount of land. How North Carolina farming got so crowded can be understood by looking at the growth of Stanley County, located in the Uwharries. There were just over 800 farms there in 1850 when North Carolina was finally becoming prosperous. Because the state was no longer Rip Van Winkle, very few of these families left the county and moved west. After the Civil War, when the children of these families grew up, they too stayed in the area and tried to farm. By 1890, Stanley had more than 2,000 farms, and those farmers were plowing twice as much land as they had before. Much of this newly farmed soil was not very productive. Farmers just starting out had a harder time making things grow than had their fathers and grandfathers. To compensate, farmers went to town and borrowed money from furnishing merchants, storekeepers who let them buy fertilizer, seeds, tools, and other supplies to make a crop. The furnishing merchants in town and at new country crossroads stores all over the state were happy to provide credit. The farmers who borrowed from the furnishing merchants had to pay interest on the money they borrowed, which made the merchants even more money. Plus, many merchants loaned money and materials to farmers only if the farmer sold his crop to that particular merchant. That put the farmer at a disadvantage, since he did not have the ability anymore to shop around for the best price. Falling crop prices. Borrowing in town created a second problem for farmers. Because they had to borrow, they increased the size of their crops to help pay back the loans. This was particularly the case in the 1890s. Cotton production went from 336,000 to 460,000 pounds. More significantly, because of the appeal of cigarettes, tobacco production grew from 36,000 pounds to 128,000 pounds. One of the rules of the marketplace is that if demand for a product does not rise, a larger supply of the commodity will lower its price. By the 1880s, North Carolina farmers were hurt in the pocketbook by the fact that so many of them were doing the same thing. The more they grew each year to pay off their loans to merchants in town, the less they got back for all their hard work. Thousands of farmers throughout the state, both black and white, went broke during the 1890s. They often could not pay off the loans to the merchants when their harvest was sold. The merchants then carried over their debt to the next spring. This also hurt the farmers because their debt kept getting bigger. The farmers then logically bought more seed, tools, and fertilizer to plant even bigger crops. When thousands continued to do the same thing, the price they received for cotton and tobacco continued to be too low to pay off their debts. A growing number of sharecroppers. While merchants in town continued to make profits that they put into factories, many white farmers fell into the same sharecropping arrangements that African Americans had been forced into during Reconstruction. Almost 93,000 farmers were sharecroppers in 1900, compared to 53,000 in 1880. Sharecropping, remember, was the arrangement between the landowner and the farmer to split the profits from the harvest. Because the landowner wanted the most for his investment, he typically required the farmer to plant one crop only, usually cotton or tobacco, which was sure to sell and be used in the state's factories. This hurt sharecroppers, for they usually had to borrow even more money to buy food and clothing for their families while they grew the crop. Thus, the debt increased again. In many areas where cotton and tobacco farming was booming, the majority of farmers were sharecroppers. Thousands of families became so discouraged they moved to town to take industrial jobs. John Fry, for example, was one of those young men from Stanley County who tried to make a living off the land. Fry had been wounded at Gettysburg and was partially disabled. He inherited about 80 acres, barely enough for himself, let alone his four growing sons. Fry borrowed year after year for 15 years, seldom making any money. In 1885, he lost his land and continued on as a sharecropper. In 1890, Fry finally packed up his family and moved to the Odell Cotton Mill in Concord. All four of his sons became weavers. North Carolina's leaders were aware by the 1880s that most farmers had problems. One of the reasons North Carolina College of Agricultural and Mechanical Arts was opened in 1889 was to help farmers learn more efficient agricultural methods. Most farmers, of course, could not afford to go to college, so they organized into groups of like-minded neighbors to help one another. By the 1890s, the state's farmers had become angry enough to turn their organization into political protest groups. Farmers' organizations. In the 1880s, one North Carolinian became the champion of farmers throughout the state. Leonidas L. Polk, an Anson County native, became the first commissioner of agriculture for the state. After serving in that post, Polk became editor of the Progressive Farmer. This Raleigh newspaper tried to advise farmers about planting and help them solve their problems. When the Farmers' Alliance, which had been started in Texas by troubled farmers, reached North Carolina in 1887, Polk headed it. By 1890, Polk had moved to Washington, D.C. to become the national head of the organization, in effect, the nation's chief farm leader. Polk died soon after. Had he lived, he might have been a strong candidate for president of the United States in 1892, because so many farmers across the nation were experiencing the same problems that North Carolina faced. The Alliance first tried to help farmers by opening farmer cooperative stores. These stores bought fertilizer and other supplies in bulk, which lowered the cost. Too many farmers, however, were already so far in debt that they could not take advantage of the offers. Most of the co-op stores did not survive. Polk and other Alliance leaders believed there was not enough money to go around in the nation to give farmers their fair share. The nation was rapidly building cities and factories in the North, and the money supply, the amount of currency and coin available for each person, was actually going down each year. If there was more money to go around, farmers would be able to borrow it at a cheaper rate. Plus, if farmers had more money in their pockets, they could grow less, which would make farm prices go up. The Alliance leadership asked Congress, and in particular Senator Zeb Vance, to pass laws that would allow the government to print new money and loan it to farmers. The farmers would use their crops as collateral, something pledged to guarantee the repayment of a loan. Vance did not like the idea because crops can easily be lost to weather or mismanagement. After Polk's death, angry Alliance leaders decided that farmers needed to elect their own congressmen to pass the new laws. Many Alliance members joined a new political group, the Populist Party, or People's Party, to accomplish this. Special feature, Carolina people, Charlie Sung. North Carolina has long had a close connection to the vast Asian nation of China. For example, in 1847, Matthew T. Yates of Raleigh became the first Christian missionary to go into that country. He served for 40 years, and hundreds of other state residents went there to do similar service. The most famous connection was a Chinese native who came to North Carolina as a refugee. He used the lessons he learned and the connections he made in North Carolina to create the most powerful family in China in the first half of the 20th century. Sung Yaoshu was one of the impoverished Chinese who came to the United States at the time of the American Civil War. Sung worked for an uncle in a shop in Boston selling silk and tea. When the uncle objected to Sung going to an American school, Sung stowed away on a ship. The ship captain took pity on him and brought him home to Wilmington. The people of Wilmington befriended him, and he joined the Fifth Avenue Methodist Church. It was at this time that he became Charlie, The local newspaper announced in 1880 that he was the first celestial, the nickname for Chinese there, that has ever submitted to the ordinance of Christian baptism in North Carolina. Sung met Julian S. Carr, the owner of Bull Durham Tobacco. Carr all but adopted Sung and paid for him to take courses at Trinity College. Carr then paid for his education at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. In 1886, Sung returned to China as a Methodist missionary. When he encountered financial hardship, he combined preaching with business. Sung proved to be an ambitious entrepreneur. After working as a translator for Westerners at the largest flour mill in China, he saw a need for Bibles written in Chinese. He printed them and sold them to other missionaries. Sung then began to print literature for the Chinese nationalists, reformers who wanted to reorganize the old empire along Western ways. Sung himself became an ardent nationalist. He also began to import the cigarettes made in Durham, which made him a multimillionaire. Sung died during World War I, but his children, all of whom were raised to be Methodists, continued to be some of the most important citizens of nationalist China. His first daughter was married to the richest man in China, H.H. Kung, head of the National Bank. His second daughter was married to the President of the Republic, Sun Yat-sen. His third daughter was married to the most important military figure of the Republic, Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek. Cheng was later the head of the nationalist government that went into exile on the island of Taiwan after World War II. His sons all created great fortunes in the Chinese Republic and later in San Francisco and New York.